Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 106, recorded Friday, September 6th, 2013. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: summer vacation in Amsterdam and restaurant trends. Well, back in the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, for a rare morning recording session. So this episode of the Travel Commons Podcast is brought to you by Chemex, the oldest name in hipster coffee. You know, I sort of took the summer off, working, biking, reading, drinking coffee, drinking beer. Nothing really exciting, which meant, I guess, you know, that I didn't have anything really new to podcast about. Which, though, doesn't mean that I haven't been traveling. I've been in the air almost every week since the last episode. New Orleans, mostly, with a few trips to Houston, a week in Amsterdam for a family vacation that we'll talk about in the first topic, and then this week in a quick up and back to Atlanta. Now, the New Orleans trips, I tell you, have taught me a key life lesson. Don't try to fly out of the Gulf Coast after 4:30 p.m. in the summer. Look, New Orleans in the summer is 91 degrees and like 91% humidity. And so what ends up happening is you sit in the airport terminal and watch the line of thunderstorms cross the runway at about 4 p.m., just bucketing down rain with lightning strikes all over the place that keep, you know, the ground crews inside. And so that's about the time that you walk over and get another beer, because I'll tell you, you're going to be there for a while. Of course, it could be worse. You could be on one of the planes that managed to land right before the squall line hit, which means you're sitting on a plane that's pulled up to the gate, but you can't get off because there's no one to pull the jet bridge up because of the lightning. You get the same weight, just no beer. So if you don't want to torture yourself, you don't fly out late afternoon. But, you know, the other problem is that after 7 p.m., New Orleans Airport is a complete ghost town. I mean, the last flight that will get me home to Chicago, even with a connection, leaves at 6:30. Save for the odd Southwest hop going to Houston, there's nothing else going out. So if I have a late afternoon meeting, I have to stay overnight. And then that means I then have to head over to the French Quarter or the Garden District or the Bywater District for a cocktail and maybe some fresh oysters, maybe a bit of gumbo or cochon. Okay, so maybe that lack of late night flight homes isn't such a bad thing after all. So following up, so all this dodging summer Gulf storms has made weather apps kind of right up there with airline and trip management apps in the critical travel apps folder on my iPhone and Nexus 7. Actually, it starts on my laptop where I have WeatherSpark on an open tab at all times. And in one browser window, I get radar images, I get temperature and precipitation forecasts. Now, on my iPhone, it's Forecast.io and then the rebuilt Yahoo Weather app. Those two really are the go-tos for me on the iPhone, and they really represent two ends of the design spectrum. So Forecast has a sort of very minimal aesthetic, lots of white space, focused, quickly giving you what it thinks most people want to know. What's the forecast for the next hour and the next 24 hours? Tapping reveals the current weather conditions, humidity, pressure, wind. Another tap, the 7-day forecast. Tap one of those 7 days, drills you down to the hourly temperature and precip forecast for that day. Now, Yahoo Weather is a little less tappy. You start with current conditions and a big picture from Flickr, and then you scroll down for forecasts and a weather map. Now, on my Nexus 7, I use SkyMotion, which is focused on short-term forecasting, very short-term. It gives me current conditions and a forecast as far ahead as it can see, like no rain for the next 115 minutes. And then it counts down to the next forecast update. I've got mine set for every 5 minutes. So, so you get all this, and I just sort of tend to triangulate across all of them, you know, for some sort of a consensus forecast. But that's because in trying to get home every week, you know, at a reasonable time, I've become a bit obsessive about weather. Now, you know, of course, maps are the critical travel app, and I don't know about you guys, but for me, Apple Maps is still lousy. I mean, I haven't used Apple Maps ever since Google launched their iPhone map app, but, you know, a few weeks back landing at O'Hare, I was in a rush to get directions and travel time to a meeting. The address was in, you know, the appointment or in the calendar app on my iPhone, so I just clicked on it and it popped up Apple Maps. A couple of clicks, I had the directions, or so I thought. As I skimmed the directions, I thought, well, this just can't be right. I looked at the address, associated with the PIN, and it was Michigan Avenue, but in Evanston, Illinois, not Chicago, Illinois. So even though the address on the appointment included Chicago, Apple decided for some reason that I really wanted it. It knew best, and I really wanted to go to Evanston. So I manually edited the address, specifically typing in Chicago into the Apple Maps app, and then hit return. But they still wanted to send me to Evanston. I was just like, okay, I don't have time for this. So I reopened the appointment, copied the address, pasted it into Google Maps, and that got me headed to Chicago. Now, playing around later that day, I found that the Apple Maps app it just doesn't feel as smart as Google Maps about my location. So standing in the loop in downtown Chicago, I put a street address into Google Maps, 525 West Monroe, and Google assumed that since I'm standing in downtown Chicago, I want to find 525 West Monroe in Chicago. Now, Apple Maps will tell me address not found unless I specifically type in Chicago. Now, I don't know. That's just a little thing, but I'll tell you, at the end of the day, you just want your answer as fast as you can get it. So, I mean, remember when this whole debacle started, back about a year ago, Tim Cook said, you know, maps would get better the more people used it. Well, I don't know. Maybe nobody's using it, but I haven't seen it get any better. But thanks to Google, I guess I'm not all that worried about it. Now, in the last two episodes, I've talked about when traveling internationally, buying a SIM card in, you know, the specific country to save on voice and data roaming charges. Now, last episode, we talked about it when I was in Spain. And now, you know, this episode, when I was in Amsterdam at the end of July, the story was really no different. Now, after landing in Schiphol, I searched out the Labara mobile booth. It was kind of in the shadow of the Burger King. It wasn't the biggest booth, so it took me a bit. It's kind of located out by kind of in that main center area before you step outside, so right where the train tickets are, ticket machines are, and stuff like that. But once I found the booth, I mean, it took the guy there all of maximum 5 minutes to get my unlocked AT&T iPhone 4 registered on the Dutch KPN network. And for 20 euros, which is about 26 US dollars at the time, I got 1 gig of data, unlimited text, and enough voice minutes to make, I don't know, a half dozen restaurant reservations. I mean, compare that to the AT&T offering of $30 for 120 meg of international data. I'll tell you, all this, both for the, you know, both for the Amsterdam trip and for the Spain trip, where I found the different offerings and did my research, was this website called prepaidwithdata.wikia.com. Don't worry, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. That ends up being, for me, like the great site, country by country, comparing prepaid data plans, actually data and voice plans. If you're an international traveler, that should be a top bookmark for you. So the Saturday we flew back from Amsterdam was the one day of bad weather, rain and low clouds. I'd booked our flights using United Miles, so while the flight over from Chicago was a nonstop United flight. For whatever reason, I couldn't get back on the return nonstop on United to O'Hare. So our flight back was on Lufthansa with a connection through Frankfurt. So we got to Schiphol a bit early, and seeing the delays, we tried to get on an earlier flight to Frankfurt. Well, I'll tell you, we weren't the only ones with that idea. The flight was full. "No worries," says the counter agent. "Your flight is only delayed 20 minutes. You'll still have an hour to make your connection." 45 minutes later, the delay is now an hour. "No worries," the gate agent said. "You still have 20 minutes to make your connection in Frankfurt." "Really?" Honestly, I just stopped for a minute and I looked at her face. Irony? Sarcasm? No, she was being genuine. Genuinely not in touch with air travel. So, boarding time, though, still now comes and goes, and we're still in the gate area. The fuel truck is completely MIA. It's missing in action. The pilot's, like, looking out the window for it. And apparently we can't board while the plane is being fueled. Now, I'd already talked to United. The connection that we're now going to miss is the last flight to the U.S. from Frankfurt, and there's no room on any nearby United flights to the U.S. until Monday. Now, this is Saturday night, then Monday. So I figure, well, okay, there's a better chance of getting us to the U.S. from Frankfurt, which is Lufthansa's main hub, than from Schiphol. So we board the flight, knowing that we're going to be overnighting in Frankfurt. Now, on the approach to Frankfurt, the flight attendant reads off all the connecting flights, the gates for the connections that are still makeable, the rebookings for those that aren't. I'll tell you, it was more information than I typically hear on a delayed flight into O'Hare. Now, according to this, we were rebooked on the next morning's flight to O'Hare, which was great news because United said it was booked up. So we head over to Lufthansa's customer service desk. There wasn't much of a line. The agent quickly finds us in the system, looks at me, my wife, my two kids, and says, "So, you'll need 2 or 4 rooms this evening." Two will be just fine, I tell him. He gives us vouchers for 2 rooms at the hotel airport, which includes €20 apiece for dinner, and then also includes breakfast. All of this on Lufthansa's dime. And remember, we're flying on awards miles. Now, think about this for a minute. If this had been in the U.S., we would have been told, "It's your fault, not our fault. You're on your own. Have a nice life." And rebooking on awards miles, I think we would have ranked like lower than non-revenue employee flights. So all of this, you know, plus the really nice service in coach on the way back to Chicago, has my wife telling me, "Look, the next time we book flights with United miles, skip them. Book everything on Lufthansa." Hey, the one thing that United does do right, though, is TSA PreCheck. Now, as I've said on previous podcasts, PreCheck is a wonderful thing. Keep your shoes and belt on, keep your liquids and PC in your bag, stroll through the metal detector, no full body irradiation. Everybody, the passengers and the TSA agents, are happy and smiling. There's a rainbow over the exit of the X-ray machine, and a sparkly unicorn happily gives you your bags at the end. Okay, I exaggerate. But just a bit. TSA PreCheck is a wonderful thing. And actually, United does a very good job of it in O'Hare and at Houston George Bush International. American, though, seems to have its challenges. Their PreCheck line at O'Hare can get very long, I'm not quite sure why and what's different about theirs in Terminal 3 from United's in Terminal 1. And somehow they've screwed up my PreCheck status because on my last 3 flights to New Orleans, I've been shunted over to the regular status line. Now, I tell you, like missing those unicorns and rainbows, I call up American. Yes, I know that PreCheck is not guaranteed and that randomly I'll have to go through the regular line. I mean, that's happened before, but I got to tell you, in my book, 3 times in a row has moved from random to an obvious screw up somewhere. I got shunted between customer service and the platinum desk. "Well, I don't know. I don't understand it. Everything looks fine." Now, then a Twitter conversation with American earlier a couple weeks ago asked that I compare the name on my Advantage account with my TSA Global Entry account. And at the same time, I looked at my United account because it's been working fine. Both the Global Entry and the United accounts have my middle name spelled out. Now, my American account just has my middle initial. Now, I was getting PreCheck on American, I don't know, a month or so ago, so I don't know where this screw up or where suddenly the fact of middle initial versus middle name, I don't know where that started to become an issue, but I updated my American account. I'll see now if that solves the problem. Now, on a recent flight down to New Orleans, I took Southwest out of Midway. That's just the way the schedules ended up working. I had to do that. Now, there's no PreCheck in Midway, and with all the families and leisure travelers who use Midway and the way security is configured, sort of everybody funnels into this single, massive, multi-line security group grope checkpoint thing, I avoid Midway at all costs. So during this rare flight, though, I asked a TSA guy when they'd be getting PreCheck. End of the year, he said. They've been reconfiguring a bunch of lanes at the right-hand side of the security checkpoint to handle it. Well, now, I've just spent 20 minutes getting through security versus what is usually 5 minutes tops in United's PreCheck line at O'Hare. You know, I might be a lot more accepting of a Southwest flight if they had PreCheck at Midway, and provided that they don't do it just for their A-list members. And then earlier this week, the TSA announced that they were going to significantly expand the PreCheck program. And I think the check fee, you know, the entrance fee is like $85. If you travel at all, it's absolutely worth it. And finally, a sort of a nice social media serendipity moment last month. I was at the Oak Park Microbrew and Food Review. I think this was the sixth year it was on, but it was the first time that I had gone. It was a kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing, so I was there by myself. I was checking in a couple of beers on Untappd, which is something like sort of Beer Geek Foursquare, and up pops a comment on one of my check-ins. "Hey, come find me. I'm in a Red Hat Linux hat." Another Untappd friend and a longtime Travel Commons podcast listener, Rob Auk, was there also. Wasn't too crowded yet, so we managed to find each other fairly quickly, and then we hung out, for an hour or so, tasting beer together. It was kind of fun, and it is, it's kind of a fun thing when the virtual world intersects the real one. Hey, and if you have any of your own serendipity stories, any travel observations, questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com is the email address. You can always use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock. Post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or you can always go old school, back to the turn of the century, 1999, and post your thoughts on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is summer vacation in Amsterdam. Look, I've been burning through award miles recently. I drained the American bank for a spring break trip to Spain. So it was United's turn for summer vacation. And since my daughter got to choose the spring break location, my son got the choice for the summer. We could only carve out a week, so Asia was out, which nixed his usual choice of Japan. "Let's look at Europe," I said. "But," as he was opening his mouth, "not Russia. I might be interested in St. Petersburg as sort of a Baltic tour, but for the rest of Russia, no thanks. You can do that on your own dime." "Fine," he said. "Then Amsterdam." "Really? Why?" "I don't know. Just a place I want to go," he said. "All right. Well, you know, actually, as I thought more about it, I got more interested. Now, I've done a good bit of work around Amsterdam and Harlem and Utrecht. I've flown in and out of Schiphol a bunch of times, but save for one windy sort of early winter afternoon, I never really spent any time in the city itself. You know, this could be fun," I thought. So as I mentioned in the last episode, we've pretty much converted from hotel rooms to vacation rentals for our family vacations. For about the same price as two hotel rooms, we get that and more. a kitchen, a living room, you know, I mean, places, you know, as a family, we can sort of, you know, sit and hang out together that aren't, you know, sitting on beds or, you know, sitting in a concierge lounge, which, you know, a bunch of other families. You know, we also like to shop in local markets. And, you know, with a kitchen, you know, this is a lot more fun. We actually get to go and buy and try things rather than just doing, I don't know, grocery tourism. So normally this works out very well, but you know, the end of July was warmer, much warmer than normal in Europe. We'd expected weather in sort of the mid-70s. We got high 80s during the day, maybe dipping into the mid-70s at night, and some really nice humidity levels. Wouldn't be bad if we were staying at a hotel with air conditioning, but we decided to do something a bit more local. We ended up renting a houseboat on the Princess Canal, which didn't come with air conditioning nor great cross ventilation, since you're kind of below the street and kind of below the breeze level when you're in the canals. So the first morning in the houseboat, I woke up, headed to the kitchen to figure out the Nespresso coffee machine. I opened the canal side door and windows to let in a bit of a morning breeze and started to rummage around the kitchen looking for the coffee capsules. Then I heard this noise behind me, and I turned and saw one of those big canal tour boats passing within a couple of feet of our houseboat, full of tourists wielding cameras, many of which were pointed through our open door, looking straight at me in my boxers. I waved. I mean, really, what else could I do? And pressed the brew button on the Nespresso coffee machine, and then kind of headed back to the bedroom for a t-shirt and a pair of shorts. Bit of a shock at first. It then became a bit of a game for the rest of the trip. Now, purposely walking around in the most colorful boxers my son and I could find, pointing our cameras back at the tour boats. The tour boat traffic on the canal was heavy. I posted a Vine video on my Twitter feed of kind of some of the passing boats. I'll put a link in the show notes. But I'll tell you, that was kind of part of the fun. We'd hang out on the little porch on the end of the day, eating some cheese, drinking a beer. It felt like we were part of the Amsterdam vibe, not just observing it. One of the best days we had of the week, we kind of spent turning the tables, where we piloted ourselves through the canals and were peeping into other houseboats. Kind of social media serendipity hit again, this time through Twitter, by way of Untappd. Arnold Hines, a longtime Travel Commons listener, follows me on Twitter. Untappd pushes beer drinking badges to Twitter. I said it was kind of like Beer Geek Foursquare. Arnold saw a Vice beer badge that I earned from a check-in at some canal side bar, and he ends up shooting me this great email with a fantastic list of suggestions. The one that immediately caught my eye was renting a boat for your own canal tour. So I get online, book a boat, hit the grocery store for some snacks, and then we walk to the rental place in Westerpark. We hop in an aluminum boat with an electric outboard motor. Just dead simple to run. We end up having to lay on the bottom of the boat right away to clear what we're told is the lowest canal bridge in Amsterdam. And then we go out for a three-hour cruise, sort of bopping around the canals, dodging the big tour boats. It was a great time. We also spent a couple of days being part of the bicycling culture in Amsterdam. I think it's impossible to say you've truly visited Amsterdam without renting a bike and spending the day cycling around. I've spent time in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Boulder, Colorado, you know, three of the top U.S. biking cities, and they just pale in comparison to Amsterdam. You know, until you get in the midst of it, you really can't appreciate that bicycles are on the top of the Amsterdam transit pyramid. Cyclists, then motorists, then pedestrians. The bicycle lanes near the central station are the craziest. They're just sort of a mosh pit of cyclists and foreign pedestrians coming out of the train station, sort of sprinting for their lives across car and bike lanes, chased by honking horns and ringing bike bells. But I don't know, get outside of town a bit, and as we did when we were biking up to Marken Island, and it settles down a lot, and actually settles down a lot very quickly. And it's really easy bicycling, except for the bridges. I mean, the country is just pancake flat. So, other tips from the week we spent there? I already mentioned hitting the Lebara stand and Skipold for that €20 for a gig of mobile data plan. That was a lifesaver. The train into Amsterdam from Schiphol is dead simple. And, you know, I love to try all these mass transit lines in from the airports. It's a great one. I mean, you know, take it if you're heading into the city. But I'll tell you, be ready. It is so dead simple that it does get crowded. The family and I loved the Van Gogh Museum. I mean, it's rare to be able to trace an artist's development in such detail over time. But understand that, hey, guess what? A lot of other people love it too. Go online and book a specific appointment, a date and a time for your visit. Then, you know, you get in that line and it moves and you move right in. It's highly recommended versus standing on the other side of the staircase case with everybody else just waiting to get in. On the other hand, so while I can highly recommend the Van Gogh Museum, skip the Heineken experience, the Heineken Brewery. It was just absolutely not worth it. You know, use your money instead. Go hit the brewery IJ. I don't know what IJ pronounces as, but it's the one microbrewery in Amsterdam in the city. It's over on the east side. When you're doing one of your bike rides, work your way over to it. You end up drinking a lot better beer underneath a windmill. It was great. It was a great time. Or there's a you know, some of the craft bars, Proflokal Arendt's Nest. Boy, I am just butchering these names. It's in the Jordan district, and they had just a phenomenal selection of Dutch microbrews, stuff you're never going to see out of the country. Again, skip the Heineken stuff and spend your money at these places. I've got links in the show notes. And we ended up staying in the Jordan district and definitely recommend it. I mean, we hit the Noordermarkt Farmers Market on Saturday to stock the houseboat kitchen. We shopped down, Harlem or Straat, stopped in at some of the neighborhood restaurants and bars. That was a great street. Love that street. We found Jordan just sort of the right mix of happening, you know, stuff going on, but it wasn't too raucous, which, I don't know, you know, if you walk down the Damrak or you're walking around the red light district, looking for something not too raucous definitely puts you in the minority. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is restaurant trends. Hey, this week's trip to Atlanta makes it 9 straight weeks that I've been on the road. So not only do I get to know airports and airplanes and hotels, but also restaurants. And I'll tell you, for the past couple of years, I've attended the National Restaurant Association's annual show here in Chicago to walk the floor and see what the trends are. You know, what can we as sort of frequent travelers expect to see when we're eating on the road? Now, last year in episode 98, I talked about last year's show where technology seemed to be the trend. Mobile apps to let you pay your tab, iPad digital menus, smartphones replacing pagers for queued up guests. Now, this year there was still a technology bent. I mean, yet more permutations on digital menus, though this time featuring some cheaper Android tablets as well as the ubiquitous iPad, and a whole lot of social apps. You know, just seems like everyone wants me to check in, upload pictures, leave comments, good ones, I assume, on their site. I got to tell you, though, I am sort of full up with social networks. Personally, I have zero interest in donating any more free content to yet another social network. Twitter, Facebook, Untappd, Food Spotting, TripAdvisor, and now a friend just talked me into Yelp. I mean, that's it. I'm over-socialed. I'm done. Now, luckily for me, though, this year's NRA floor, and remember I said restaurant, not rifle, the R in NRA here. The floor had, maybe not new food trends, but certainly some clearer, perhaps more consensus trends. I mean, two that jumped out at me were Mediterranean and Japanese food. Now, I know, how new is Mediterranean? But if in the years past, Mediterranean was a label used to push more expensive Italian food, I felt like I saw more of the Mediterranean this year, specifically more of the Eastern Mediterranean. Greek, Turkish, Lebanese, with different, sort of interesting flavors, sumac, pomegranate, tahini, less basil, more oregano, less pork, more lamb. Look, nothing against Italian. I love Italian. But anything that brings more flavor choices, I'm all for that. Japanese was also a big presence this year, but not sushi so much, although there was a very cool automated sushi maker that, I tell you, had me like fixed in space for like 10 minutes just watching it churn out, automatically churning out bits of sushi. But, sort of instead of sushi, it was really sort of the broader spectrum of Japanese flavors, noodles, green teas, umami, that, that newest basic taste. You got sweet, sour, salty, bitter that we all learned in bio, and now umami, sort of a meaty, savory taste that is at the core of many Japanese flavors. Think mushrooms. Japanese noodles seem to be all the rage now. Ramen, udon, soba. I mean, on the floor of the show, a Japanese company had an entire automated noodle making assembly line running, and watching those big fat udon noodles roll off, I tell you, made me hungry. But like I said, anything that adds variety to your restaurant choices is a great thing. Now, I remember some years back, I was traveling every week to St. John, New Brunswick. Now, I won't bore you with the hassles of getting there from Chicago. Just to suffice it to say, with no customs in St. John Airport, and this is St. John as in New Brunswick, not St. John's as in Newfoundland. So with no customs, you just can't get there from here. St. John is a nice town. It really, really little port town. It was really nice. But the choices were a bit limited. Monday night, we'd have salmon. Atlantic salmon, very fresh, very good. Tuesday, we'd have mussels, PEI mussels, Prince Edward Island mussels, just the next province over. Again, very fresh, very good. Wednesday, we're starting to sprout gills, so we'd have a hamburger. Less fresh, but washed down with fresh Moosehead beer from next door in Nova Scotia. Thursday, well, it was back to salmon. Still fresh, perhaps a little less good. Look, I'm certainly not having, a variety problem on my weekly commutes to New Orleans. But for those travelers headed to sort of less culinary interesting destinations, I hope that the variety that I saw on the floor of the NRA show, the National Restaurant Association show, reaches you real soon. Okay, that's it. That's the End of Travel Commons podcast number 106. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast. And those of you who hung around through my summer break, thanks for sticking with it. Thanks for keeping subscribed, and I hope you stay subscribed. Hey, the bridge music is from the CC Mixter website, a Creative Commons site. Test Drive by Zapac, Drops of H2O, The Filtered Water Treatment by Jay Lang, and Black Rainbow by Pitsk, P-I-T-X, Pitsk, I don't know. Anyhow, you'll find links in the show notes if you're interested in checking those out. And hey, as always, if you've got any thoughts, a story, experience, a gripe, moans and groans, cries of anguish, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at TrevilCommons.com or to M. Peacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook or post them on our website at TravelCommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on Facebook or on the website. I don't think that the gap until the next episode will be as long as this last one. But until we speak again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
On the road, life is hell. Strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind. The warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone, within my heart you'll find my picture's